Today, I'd like to welcome Professor Richard Cash. Professor Cash is a senior lecturer on global health at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health. He is also world-renowned for developing and conducting the first clinical trials of oral rehydration therapy, known as ORT, in adult and pediatric cholera patients in Bangladesh. Professor Cash, welcome.
Thank you.
Before we dive into that and your wonderful and amazing discovery, could you take us back about how you ended up in Bangladesh?
Well, the story is, I guess, a bit convoluted. I had finished medical school and was taking my internship, and during this time, the United States was very engaged in the Vietnam War, and there was some mandate that said every physician had to serve, and so you could either finish your training or go at some point in time and enlist in the military or one of the armed services. I was actually quite opposed to the war, as were many others, and was contemplating whether I want to move to Canada, but that fortunately that decision was taken from me when I got into the U.S. Public Health Service. And I was assigned to the National Institutes of Health, and they assigned me to work at what was then called the Pakistan CETO Cholera Research Laboratory, based in Dhaka, East Pakistan. So I guess they made the decision for me. And so after my internship, I packed up and headed out to Dhaka. I think at one point I thought I was going to Dakar, but I was quickly corrected on that. I knew nothing about India, nothing about Pakistan, nothing about cholera, and in fact, very little about childhood diarrhea, even though this was responsible for almost 30% of the deaths in low and middle income countries. But it was not an issue at that time in the United States, and I was simply learning the health issues of the United States. So to say I was ill-prepared was, I suppose, a fairly good summary. I had done my internship in surgery, and a lot of surgery is about water and electrolytes. It's about maintaining hydration during surgery, after surgery, and so on. And since the treatment of diarrhea is really about water and electrolytes, it was possible that they thought that I was a good candidate for this position. I never followed up on that. I just accepted my fate and packed up one footlocker with, I have no idea what I put into it. I didn't have very much. Certainly my winter clothes were not going to be of much value. And a few books and headed out and flew to Karachi. And I remember being booked at a airport hotel and somebody coming around and said that they wanted to take my shoes to polish them, evidently, but I had never seen a servant or someone of that nature, and I had no idea. So reluctantly, I gave them my shoes and they did polish them. And I ended up in Dhaka the next day. I had stopped for a brief time in Ethiopia because I had have a sister who was then in the Peace Corps. So that was really my first encounter at all with low and middle income countries. I knew nothing about it. I ended up in Dhaka then a couple of days later and was met at the airport and ensconced in the home of one of the foreigners who was on leave at the time. And it was this very, very nice house. And I thought, I had no idea. I thought I was going to be in a Peace Corps type situation. I had missed the orientation. I had forgotten about it, or I was on duty that night. And when my colleague David Nalen, who arrived a couple of days before I did, was there with another physician who had just returned, John Lindenbaum, I had sort of missed the orientation, so I had I was clueless, basically. I was clueless. And that's how it all began.
And so when you were studying to become a surgeon here, were you really focused on thinking about U.S. public health system?
Yes, yes.
It wasn't, you didn't have this global aspiration at that point.
I had no concept whatsoever of what health issues, what health was like in South Asia, certainly. And I had always wanted to do an overseas stint, but I really didn't know what it meant. Was it like Tom Dooley and being a sort of a missionary doctor? Or certainly I was not religiously inclined to do anything like that. So I had no idea. So I was really starting from scratch, quite honestly. I did not know what the laboratory was about. I didn't know much of the health problems. I was a fresher, so to speak.
And so what did you encounter when you arrived in Dhaka? What was the situation? Can you paint a picture for us of what was
happening? Well, the institution that I was assigned to, which was called the Pakistan SETO. SEATO is the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. So Pakistan was part of that. And they had Pakistan SETO Cholera Research Laboratory. I think they were looking for some sort of humanitarian-like institution to be the face of SETO in East Pakistan. A military alliance probably was not high on their agenda. This was a manifestation of it. And cholera was a major health problem in Thailand and in Southeast Asia, so it did make some sense. So this was what I defined it as humanitarian. It wasn't humanitarian. It was a research laboratory looking at health issues that were common to that part of the world. And that's where I ended up. And in that situation, I was asked to, as were the others, there were seven of us, I think, seven or eight of us, were asked to look after patients and also do research on cholera to see if there was another way of treating it, if we could treat it, to sort of wave the flag of SETO in that area. Something that none of us were particularly excited about, but we're very interested in being at this research laboratory, doing things that we thought and was clearly very important.
And so tell us a little bit about the epidemic of cholera in the country. What did that look like? What did it look like on the ground? What were you seeing? How does it?
Well, cholera is simply the most severe of all the diarrheal diseases. So diarrhea killed at that time, so we're going back to 67, killed about close to 30% of children. So the real issue with diarrhea was not cholera, but just routine childhood diarrhea. But this was set up as a cholera research laboratory, since cholera was in that part of the world, was endemic, and was greatly feared, and of course affected adults as well as children. And something that kills adults within a few hours is obviously something very important. And so that's why we were there. We were there to look at how to treat cholera, maybe come up with a better treatment of it for adult patients. That's who we focused on. It was only later on that we became very, very involved in treating pediatric diarrhea and so on, for which ORT is now the primary treatment. And cholera is of less and less consequence.
And so at that point, how were they treating it? And where did you start to identify this gap and what could be done?
Well, lots of people had wanted to try to develop a form of therapy that could be given at home, because there were not a lot of doctors, very few nurses, not a lot of hospitals and so on. So the ideal place to begin treatment to mitigate severe dehydration. See, with cholera or other diarrheas, the morbidity, that is the illness, and the death is caused from dehydration. It'd be like if you were on the desert, but it took place in 6 hours or 10 hours or whatever. And so it was, how do you make sure that people who had this particular illness would be, have their hydration restored, and you could maintain that hydration until their diarrhea stopped, because they all do. If you can do that, the individual will survive. If you cannot correct the dehydration that occurs account for further losses, because the diarrhea continues, then the patient could die. And that, as I said, about 30% of childhood deaths, that is under five, were due to diarrheal disease. And in a severe cholera epidemic, you could lose 25, 30, 35% of those people who ended up in the hospital. And it was scary, in the fact that you could die very, very quickly. And so anything that takes you down in a few hours is feared. And that's what happened. And this was the home of cholera. Bangladesh, it became Bangladesh, it was East Pakistan when I was there, is essentially a river delta. And wherever you have lots of water, diarrhea becomes a problem. So the Nile Delta, the Mekong Delta, the Mississippi Delta, before good water and sanitation gets into the area. And Bangladesh was the Ganges Delta, anyway. So diarrhea was a major threat. In addition to the fact that here was a country that at that time, it is now tripled, but at that time, it was about 55 million people. But it was the same size as the state of Wisconsin or the state of Florida. So the population density was 20 times greater, or close to that. People were living in rural huts for water and sanitation. So diarrhea was a major health problem, not just for children, but for adults. And the cholera outbreaks would periodically occur and would have its results, which was deaths in adults, men and women, and children. Although most of the child deaths were due to just routine diarrheal disease due to other causes.
So you're at this research lab. There's this epidemic happening outside your doorstep, and you start to think, and this was sort of the task at hand, which is how do you start to find something that it can become treatable at home? And so how did that experimentation start working?
Well, what happened was there was a good treatment for this and dehydration in a hospital. We could do that. We could rehydrate people with intravenous fluid through the veins. The problem is that most of the people that we were providing care to were getting sick at home, and often in rural areas, there was one doctor for every 50,000 people and hardly any nurses and so on. And so it had become clear to people years before that if you were really going to cut back on this, you had to try to get therapy where people were, at home. And that, and there, the only sense was that it had to be an oral solution, because the people to insert the IV were not there. There was not very much intravenous, which has to be sterile. So both the equipment, the solution, and the people to administer it were present. So beginning in the, I can't say when it began, probably in the late 50s, people became more and more interested in trying to develop a type of therapy that could be given at home that would cut back on the IV that you required, ideally given at home, and ideally given by non-professionals, because there weren't any. So that was the goal. We had plenty of intravenous fluid because we were a research laboratory, we had access to all this. But lots of hospitals didn't have it. They didn't have the tubing and the intravenous equipment that they needed. And a lot of these cases, most of them were occurring at home, and there was not the trained people to deliver. So there had been this desire to try to move therapy to make it cheaper and to move it away from the hospital into the home, because the feeling was if you could start treatment there, you might even obviate the need for bringing them into hospitals. So that was the sort of overwhelming goal. Now, people had tried different solutions, they had done physiologic studies, and so on. And to many, it seemed like a very interesting concept, but still an adult, which is what we were treating, would take 10 liters of fluid, the average. And for us, many of us, it seemed like an awful lot to give to somebody orally. But that was the goal. The goal was to try to move it away from intravenous, not needing the specialized people to give it, not needing sterile fluid, tubing, and so on, to an oral solution that would obviously be cheaper and might even be able to be given at home, though we didn't know. That was the goal.
And what launched the experimentation? Where did yours fit into this?
Well, people had done physiologic studies trying out different solutions by giving it through a tube into the stomach and intestine. And there seemed to be a net absorption. But again, the idea that you could actually do it was still many, many, many doubted, most doubted. And so the first goal was to see, could it work clinically? Could you do it clinically? Attempts have been made in the Philippines, but it did not work out. They hadn't used the right formula, and some people got too much sodium. So our first task was, could it work? Could you actually save intravenous fluid? Because that was our goal. Could we save it? And so we did very careful, balanced studies on adult men originally, and then men and women. The men because it was easier to collect the urine than it was with women. And we showed in our initial studies that you could save up to 80% of the intravenous fluid. Now this is really exciting, because that meant that the 10 liters that would normally be used to treat a severe adult patient, of which the mortality at that time was 30% or whatever it was, although in our hands it was essentially zero, because they came to us and we knew how to treat it with intravenous fluid, that 10 liters instead of treating one person could now treat five people or four people, because you needed 2 liters to correct their shock. And then if you could save that much intravenous fluid, you could put them on oral fluid and obviate the need for that much intravenous fluid. So we got it from 10 liters down to 2 liters. That was very exciting. And then we started to push beyond that. Could we get it to less than 80% saving? Could we give it in a way that was easier to use rather than having somebody stand next to the bed and coax the person and so on? Were there ways to make it easier and simpler? And so we proceeded along that line. And then it became obvious that if this was going to work with adults, it was going to work with children. Why not? So then we tried it with kids, and then we tried it with cholera first, because that's why we were there. And then there were other diarrheas, like caused by, it's not important, but E. coli. In fact, everything we tried it with worked. Now, that's sort of, wow, it works for everything. So if anybody came in with severe diarrhea, first of all, if they were in shock, they had to be corrected through intravenous fluid. But if they weren't in shock, if they came in early on, then you could start them on this right away. And if you could save 80% or 70% of the intravenous fluid, one, you could reach those people who where there was no intravenous fluid available. You could stretch out that one resource that you had to cover many more people. You might even obviate the need for intravenous if you started early. And so gradually the boxes opened up and you began to see increasing use for it wasn't just for cholera. Turns out that it worked for essentially everything we tried, which is rare, of course. To find something that works for everything. And the most important thing is that it worked for children, because there were adults dying of diarrhea, particularly in cholera epidemics. But the vast majority of deaths from diarrhea being the larger category, cholera just being a severe diarrhea, the possibilities for reducing mortality increased manifold. And this was clearly recognized by WHO and others, USAID, and they started having international conferences and all sorts of things all over the place, and we kept getting going here and there. Then my 2 years ran up, as did David's, and our Bengali colleagues were still there, or I should say Pakistani colleagues, because it wasn't Bangladesh yet. And then I left, and all the foreigners left, the Bangladeshis or Bengalis stayed, and it began to gather momentum, and there were international conferences and so on, because this, first of all, it addressed a very common problem. 30% of adult or childhood diarrhea deaths, or 30% of child deaths were due to diarrhea. And it was low cost. It fulfilled all of the Alma-Ata criteria, low cost, common problem, effective, usable potentially by non-physicians and nurses. So then gradually, step by step, it expanded. And I think that was a valuable thing, because had they tried to do everything all at once, there would have been failures, because every step of the way was a learning experience. First of all, what conditions could you use it for? Who could give it? What were the ground rules about giving it? Could you simplify it? Did you have to do very intricate plus minus input output? Because that's all the treatment of most diarrhea is. It's just simply output diarrhea, input intravenous or oral solution. And so now you had something that was affordable, not made out of exotic ingredients, just stuff at my house, could be given, then we tried it, having mothers try it, and so on. So gradually it evolved in time. I left Dhaka in 1970, but by then it had gathered momentum, and I was doing consulting for WHO as national programs began to develop, because others saw the tremendous possibilities here. To step back a bit, a good friend of mine was a man by the name of Fazli Abed, who founded and became the director of BRAC, which is now the world's largest NGO, BRAC. It stood for the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee, but they just dropped all the stuff and called it BRAC. Governments, by and large, tend to be very conservative when it comes to introducing new technologies and new things, and they were sort of slowly getting into introducing ORT in government clinics and so on. But Abbott felt his being a population-based NGO, very directed towards empowering women, especially mothers, felt that this should be expanded. And so working in his kitchen, he sort of devised a method of using a pinch, three-finger pinch of salt and a scoop of sugar. It wasn't a complete formula, but it was enough to correct much of the dehydration. And that proved to be effective, that simple solution. The key then was, well, how do you get people to use it? How do you get them to make it, accept it, use it? And he did a pilot study on that, and with a fellow who was visiting them at the time, Ted Ellerbach, I believe his name was, and it proved that mothers could make it, and they could do it, and you could teach people, and you could evaluate them, and so on. And then he felt, because BRAC, which is now the world's largest NGO, should, the slogan was, small is beautiful, but big is necessary. And so he wanted to expand this program throughout the country. Well, you weren't going to do that through government, because the government would work with its own clinics and so on. So he started up a program called OTEP, Oral Therapy Education Program, and got a huge buy-in from the Swiss, and I'm trying to think of who else. I think they got money from AID, I'm not sure, but the Swiss were the major donors, and wanted to expand this throughout the whole country using this pinch and scoop method. Well, we did some pilot studies, it was effective, people could learn, and so then it became a matter of developing a good teaching and management system. And I was recruited to come in and work with them on that. So that's the sort of short version of a longer story. But by that time, this was now late 70s, there had been a lot of papers published showing that this was effective, it worked, it was safe, that it really was, had the potential to greatly expand, but you had to develop a method of teaching and learning and evaluation and all the messy stuff that oftentimes the researchers don't want to deal with. They want to show you that it works, now let's go on to the next issue. So I was very involved in that end of it, which was very good because I had been involved in the first clinical trials, and then the later clinical trials, and then the actual scaling up. And that's an unusual opportunity. And that's what I did.
I mean, pretty amazing that this one opportunity really changed so many things from, you know, you were training to be a surgeon.
That's right.
And I, you know, in it says in 1987, UNICEF, a report said there's no other single medical breakthrough of the 20th century that's had the potential to prevent so many deaths over such a short period of time and at so little cost.
Well,
I mean, what does that say looking back at that?
I'll leave it for others to make that assessment, but it was a remarkable, and I think that's why we call the book The Simple Solution, because in some ways it's very simple. But it's based on very good physiological studies and flux studies and so on. So a lot of very good science went into it. But ultimately, the final product ended up being actually quite simple in terms of the cost of the ingredients and how to use it and so on. And I suppose I have incorporated that into my thinking on other health issues, that there are possible ways of making things more accessible, attainable, and sustainable if you start to think along these lines.
And do you think that South Asia was a great ground for all that, just given resource limitations and things like that, that sort of...
Yeah, I think that sometimes that having shortages actually push you to look for alternative solutions or simple solutions. That doesn't mean that the solution itself is simple, because this was based on some very well-conducted, very good physiologic studies. But that ultimately, if it's going to be widely employed, it has to be along those lines. The same thing, by the way, happened with COVID-19. We ended up, I'm not talking about the United States now, but a lot of poor countries, which ended up having fairly low mortalities, were based on a relatively basic approach of putting the person in a certain sitting position and oxygen, and it was not based on high-end pharmaceuticals. Now, I have never treated a case, but that's my reading of all the literature. And so that's what this represented in its own way. And it came along at the right time. Alma-Ata was coming along. It came along at a time when people were pushing the whole idea of primary health care, of putting care into the hands of mothers and families. It came along at just the right moment. And it was strongly backed by WHO and by others who saw this as an opportunity to accomplish some of the things that they wanted to do. And if we look at what's happened to, you know, it's quite remarkable. When I went to Dhaka in 67, the infant mortality, the under five mortality was about 170, 167. It's now less than 30. That's in 50 years. That's incredible. And most of that has come about through public health, through vaccines, through simple solutions.
It's pretty amazing.
It is amazing that within my brief professional lifetime, because it's 55 years or something like that, this has happened.
And just one final question to think about, you know, we're the Mitchell Institute here, you had this long connection with South Asia. What interests you, I know you've had a long connection with BRAC, what are some of the things that interest you today with the region?
Well, I think, you know, it's, you know, all of the issues and the problems of population density and food issues and so on, but I'm fascinated by the fact that mortality and morbidity, I mean, think about it. In 55 years, the infant mortality, and not just in Bangladesh, but it's dipped in most of the countries of that region significantly in the health sector, and not based on high-end interventions. Mostly vaccines have played a huge role. ORT, some antibiotics, public health interventions, water, sanitation, and so on. So to piece it all together, I wouldn't be so foolish as to say this was the one thing or two things. A lot of things happen. Roads. Well, when I first went to Dhaka, I had to cross two ferries and take a motorboat to get to the rural treatment center in Matlam. Today you can drive there, okay? It was not electrified. Today it's electrified. All the boats were wind powered. Today they're all motorized. So it's not like things have stood still. Lots of things have happened during this period of time. But it shows what can be accomplished through education. I mean, when I was there, literacy among women was 5% or less. I don't know what it's like now, but my guess is that for girls under 16, it's no different than boys, or very close to what boys are right now. So in terms of other development indicators, electricity, education, roads, food, so on, there have been remarkable changes that have taken place. And I think health is a representation of that. Could things have been done differently? Could they have been done quicker? Well, I'll leave that to others to decide. I suppose anything could be done quicker, and so on. And then there was Bangladesh itself became an independent country. So there are lots of things that have taken place. But it's remarkable what's happened. In literally, well, I went out there in 67. It's, how many years is that? Almost 60 years.
Almost 60. Coming up, well, yeah. 55,
so,
yeah.
I remain cautiously optimistic about certain things. Others, maybe less so. But and I've been very privileged to have been able to be part of that journey.
Thank you for sharing that journey with us. That was such a fascinating story to hear how this happened. Such an amazing, simple solution, as we've said, with such an amazing impact that still people are talking about today, using today.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
quite remarkable.
Who said, oh yeah, when I was a kid, my mom gave me them. Oh, good.
I still carry them in my kitchen cabinet myself.
Well,
so
I recommend all travelers take at least one or two packs with them.
Good.
Or at least know how to make it at home.
Okay, well, thank you, Professor Cash. That was amazing. Thank you so much.
Is that-